That's hello, Tracy, my audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:03 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is June 26th. Well, there are quite a few things to talk about today. I think first, the behavior of CEOs is the thing that's really front of my mind at the moment. I feel mildly annoyed by some of the actions of some of the key CEOs in various companies. Then we have what's been going on in Russia over the course of the weekend. A lot of bluster, not a lot of action. Then there was an interesting chart I want to share with you about what's going on in China, where the savings rate is really jumping higher. Then it looks like the technology sector is starting to roll over. And then there's a, I think, a very interesting chart of where Tesla expects their spend and their capacity. The they're talking about exaflops now of compute capacity for both autonomous driving and then for their robots as well. So all of that is happening against a background where we also have the banking sector still under pressure. We still have interest rates that look like we're at the point now where central banks are likely to make a mistake. And the number of parts of the yield curve that are inverted is approaching levels that really haven't been seen in quite a while. So I thought, first, though, I would share with you the chart of Goldman Sachs. So it has bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average on three separate occasions, and it's coming back to test it again. And one thing that we can certainly say is that this has not been the most consistent of charts, and that I think more than anything helps to highlight that despite the fact that since its IPO it's up from 50 to 300, the reality is that the company is managed for its employees. But the CEO is a DJ. So how focused are you on the daily business of the operation if you're spending half your time or messing around enjoying yourself? Perhaps it's time to give up and give over responsibility of managing the company to somebody who really is interested in making money. And the big challenge, I think, for Goldman Sachs is that, and we can simply see it if we look at the financial analysis by product, because it's often regarded as an investment bank. But the reality is that asset and wealth management is now a very significant portion of income. But then, of course, how much of the balance sheet does that asset and wealth management occupy? And we've seen, for example, that companies like Blackstone are offloading some of their warehouse space to Prologis, and the share was in positive territory today, but it really needs to bounce a bit more convincingly than it is doing at present from the region of the 200-day, excuse me, 1,000-day moving average, in order to confirm a return to demand dominance. But then I think we also have to just pay attention to the wider banking sector. And the wider banking sector is still in a downtrend, and it is pulling back now from the lower side of the overhead trading range in mildly positive territory today, but at least a sustained move above 300 is the minimum requirement to confirm a return to demand dominance. And then just sticking with the big CEOs, because you have Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg talking about having a cage fight in Las Vegas. Now, I don't really care which one of them wins or not, but how focused are you on the day-to-day nitty-gritty of trying to manage a trillion-dollar company if what you're in fact thinking about doing is scrapping it out with one of your competitors? And I think the stock market might be beginning to pay attention to this kind of lack of focus in an environment where It is seven companies have accounted for the vast majority of performance from the S&P 500 this year. Tesla is very overbought in the short term. It's expensive to short, but it does look very likely that it is going to unwind this short-term overbought condition. And then let's also pay attention to Meta. Now, it was very oversold at the end of last year, and it has rebounded very impressively, going from under 100 to almost 300 in a little more than about 7 months. It is an exceptionally impressive move. But we should pay attention to the fact that 300 is the lower side of the overhead top formation. And this really reminds me of the very first example at the chart seminar. So we can see that we may be on the cusp of looking at an example of past support becoming future resistance. And it's a natural area where I think we're going to see some profit taking, even in the benign environment where all we get is mean reversion. It could pull back by $100 or 33%. So there's obviously some risk here. Now, let's just zoom out, look at the Nasdaq. The Nasdaq 100 has been doing spectacularly well this year, but now it is starting to pull back. And we have had really a spectacular advance, which is eerily similar to the performance of the Nasdaq in 2000, where we had the big pullback, we had this incredible rebound, and then earnings started to really underperform, and the high valuations could no longer be justified in a rising interest rate environment, which is basically exactly what we have right now. So we've had this incredible rebound in the Nasdaq at the bare minimum. The likelihood of a reversion to the mean looks more likely than not, and that could be at least a 10% pullback from where we are right now. So then let's just think about the bond market. So 10-year yields contracted in early trading, not quite holding on to all of the decline in here today. I had an interesting conversation with one of my buddies over the weekend, and he's the COO of a fairly large marketing company that really focuses on blue chip companies. What he was saying was that Wall Street scared the big blue chip companies at the end of last year, and they stopped spending. They thought that a recession was imminent, so they stopped spending on marketing. Then, because we haven't had a recession, they've started spending again. Now, of course, what that has also done has, because they're spending coming through from these companies, and it's helping to revitalize some of the balance sheets of all these other companies that depend on them. And because of that spending going on, it's also helping to ignite a consumer interest. But because consumers are still spending, it's really incentivizing central banks to be more aggressive in raising interest rates because they're not getting the objectives that they want in terms of inflation. And this is really, I think, absolutely one of the best examples of what you see in an inverted yield curve scenario. People initially panic when you get the first inversion because they think there's going to be a recession, so they stop spending. But then the recession doesn't come back, so then they pick up spending again. They say, well, everything's going to be all right. We're going to have a soft landing. But then, because of all that spending, inflation doesn't come down nearly as quickly as everybody wanted. So then interest rates continue to go up. And this is, I think, a very good example of what happens with yield curves. First, one portion of the yield curve becomes inverted, then lots do. And by the time we get up to around where we are right now, well, then there aren't too many more portions of the market can become inverted. And then that is a real signal of tighter liquidity conditions. Eventually, when the number of portions of the yield curve that are inverted starts to contract. Well, that usually happens before a recession. And well, that would suggest that that is, I think, the primary reason I have such strong conviction that a recession is absolutely inevitable. And even back in 2019, and I think this is the this is something that people tend to forget. We had a large number of inverted yield curves heading into the pandemic, and that was the primary reason for why central banks were so quick to cut interest rates and boost liquidity, because they had been tightening. In 2019, there was the real threat of deflation. We had been going through a period of quantitative tightening, and there were real fears about deflation. When the pandemic hit, there was already the risk of a recession. We already had very exaggerated valuations on private companies. And let's just remind ourselves that we'd also seen companies like Uber coming to market at extraordinary valuations in the middle of 2019. And then those valuations were very exaggerated. Now, since then, Uber has survived and the share has been doing better, but it's been a long process over the last few years of consolidation. And Lyft is barely surviving. So what this has helped to highlight is that what you get during one of these periods is survivor bias, and lots of other companies fail. We've definitely seen that in the ride-hailing sector, for example. But in 2019, it was likely there was going to be a recession in 2020. And then we got one and everything got accelerated. But the most important thing is that valuations continued to rise. And I think that is by far one of the most important factors. So then when we think about the wider market, I think when we look at how much enthusiasm has been priced into the technology sector, well, this, I think, is a great chart. It's from Tesla, and they're basically now thinking about how much additional A100 GPUs they're going to need to achieve their goal of being a 100 exaflop AI-driven company. They anticipate that by October of 24. So less, well, not quite a year and 50, well, I guess, where are we? About June now, so 16 months from now. And at the moment, they're less than 100,000, and they anticipate being at 300,000. So, well, the A100 is produced by NVIDIA. If we had to think of one good reason why NVIDIA's share price went vertical, it's because of that. It's because they anticipate, everybody anticipates that there's going to be this exponential growth in demand for GPUs for AI compute. So, how much of that is already in the price? And the share is starting to come back down. Having gone from 100 to 400 in the space of 7 months, we are incredibly overbought, and the valuation is extraordinary. Even in a mean reversion type of environment, it could halve. So we're certainly in a more risky environment for stocks generally. Now, let's think about what's happening in China. Well, the savings rate in China is gone to really rather extraordinary levels. So we can definitely think about what's been happening in the Chinese economy. Everything's been slowing down. Everyone anticipated that in the aftermath of the end of the COVID lockdowns, there would be this massive swell of spending. But instead, what has happened is that the savings rate has pretty much been vertical over the last few years, and people aren't spending. They're worried about the housing market. They're worried about the administration. They don't see the traditional levers of growth in the economy. They're worried about geopolitical tensions. And this is obviously something that Chinese consumers are doing. They're literally holding their assets. They're not spending. Well, I think this is most particularly important when we look at the environment for copper. I continue to see people talking about a super cycle for metals, and I have some sympathy with the view that there's a lot of political will to develop renewable energy and that there will be continued investments in carbon capture and those types of technologies. But the copper price is going down. We have the Type 2 top formation and a period of right-hand extension, and it is encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. I've also seen these claims, and it is fairly well backed up, that inventories are exceptionally low, but we have a clear long-term contango, and this contrasts really quite acutely with the shape of the curve for oil, for example. So the oil market really does look like there is a supply shortage. Copper doesn't. And this is also indicative of slowing Chinese demand. And now the Chinese government, we've come out of the Dragon Boat Festival holiday, and no real sign of additional stimulus to support the economy. So they've been cutting interest rates in a piecemeal fashion. There's no big swell of new credit creation, and the banking sector is rolling over. The H-share index was in negative territory today and pulling back from the region of the 200-day moving average. Two more of the property developers have missed bond payments, and the banking sector is rolling over. So, as we think about whether we're likely to have an inflationary or a deflationary environment, I think it's probably worth considering that if we look at containers, then the cost of a 40-foot container is down now to about $1,500, and that is well inside the range that preceded the pandemic. So we're at the market has completely normalized. If that is the case, if China really is slowing down and demand there isn't going to meet expectations, that enhances the potential that there's going to be a deflationary outcome, that some of the key levers of global growth are not firing. Now, we are already seeing that some countries are cutting interest rates. Vietnam has begun to cut interest rates, and the VanEck Vietnam ETF it's now pushed back above the 200-day moving average, and it's improving. What I find most particularly interesting is the divergence in performance that we have between some of these Vietnam funds. So the Vietnam Opportunity Fund is now pulling back towards the 1,000-day moving average, and has held a sequence of lower rally highs for a year and a half already. So for an individual country, we're getting really quite marked differences in performance. But of course, there will be other countries that will be cutting interest rates, and they've already got inflation under control, and Brazil is certainly one of those. So it is very bank and commodity weighted. So that's obviously going to be a factor in the performance of the ETF, but it is now testing the region of the 1,000-day moving average, the succession of lower rally highs, and we may get some consolidation here. It's a bit overbought in the short term, but then the likelihood is that when you have a stronger currency, that is going to be a main draw. Even if interest rates start to come back down, the fact that they've got inflation under control and have positive real rates is likely to be a, I think, a vote of confidence, or at least it'll be something that will induce confidence in foreign investors. And Mexico's ETF is also a little bit overbought in the short term and does look like it's going to get some consolidation. But they have gotten control of their inflation rate, and it's likely to be one of the main beneficiaries of the nearshoring or friend-shoring themes. And I think these markets will be buys on the dip for the foreseeable future. And then, of course, we have India, where the Nifty index is right at the upper side of the range that's been forming for the last 2 years and is also susceptible to a little bit of a pause and consolidation. So we're in an environment where interest rates are still rising, where central banks are very much in danger of an accident, and where I think some of the most acute risk of an accident is in the UK, where the government is now picking a fight with public sector unions and saying that Rishi Sunak was basically saying today that he is not going to abide by the recommendations of the Independent Panel on Remuneration. So that is taking what Andrew Bailey had to say last week seriously. But the FTSE 250 is pulling back from the region of the 200-day moving average, and there's still a downward bias to trading. Even though the valuation is attractive, this performance from the index is perhaps a better indication of what investors expect, which is that valuations are more or less pricing in that earnings aren't going to be able to keep up. Now, the pound hasn't rallied despite the fact that the Bank of England raised rates by 50 basis points last week. It's starting to come back down, but not in a dynamic manner. The reality is that the USA is going to be issuing a great deal of debt, and they would certainly like yields to be quite a bit lower if they're going to do that at an attractive price. In a deflationary environment, though, bonds do start to become more attractive. Now, when we think about what are the things that are contributing to inflation, well, commodity prices are one of them, wages are another, services trying to keep up with the inflation is another. And of course, there is also the argument that rising interest rates contribute to inflationary pressures by pushing up the price of property, for example, at least in the short term. But what is less understood is that eventually higher interest rates start to eat into the ability of consumers to buy. And when purchases start to ebb, then earnings roll over and it starts to become problematic. The yield curve has been inverted for over a year already, and I think that it is quite likely that we are more likely to have a deflationary outcome than an inflationary outcome over the course of the next several months. Now, gold prices continue to pull back here to test the region of the 200-day moving average in the sequence of higher reaction lows. And Bitcoin was also a little bit softer in here today as we saw some profit taking. It is going to require the catalyst of ETFs being permissioned in order to reignite a clear demand dominant environment. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.